Applying the Bible to One's Life was presented by Jack Crabtree on December 2, 2003, at McKinsey Study Center's Tuesday night class. This is the 10th talk in part 1 of a series entitled Doing Christianity. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
The whole series this year is, we titled it Doing Christianity, because the question in front of us is, we're Christians, what is it that we do when we're Christians? And this quarter has been devoted to one component of what we think we do, and that is, what it means to pursue Christianity is to pursue a knowledge of the truth. And so we call this quarter Knowing the Truth. Next quarter is going, we have titled Embracing the Truth, and it's going to explore what exactly it is, having known the truth, how is it that you actually commit yourself to it, believe it, and act on it? What does it mean to genuinely embrace that truth that we can know? Because that's the next component of what it means to be a Christian. So, with that in mind, what I want to do tonight, I'm going to shift gears a little bit because Ron actually already quite eloquently spoke to the topic that I was assigned to tonight last week on applying the Bible. So I'm going to have a few things to say about that, but I'm going to try to leave some time so that if there are any questions that you might have on that's left over with respect to the issue of what does it mean to know the truth? How do Christians go about knowing the truth? And particularly, how do we know it from the Bible, which is what the last several weeks have been concerned with. If there are any questions floating around, I'll try to leave time at the end to address those. So you might jot down a note to yourself if you think you have a question you want to pursue. But let me review just very briefly what is involved in applying the Bible to our lives. There are two things that I think are important to understand and to note in order to answer that question. The first thing is, what exactly is the nature of the Bible? What is the Bible? Different Christians have a different perspective on what the Bible is. I know in my own life, I have my perspective on what the Bible is, what the nature of the Bible has shifted over time. I think fairly early in my Christian life, the model that was taught to me is that the Bible is a kind of owner's manual for life. That what God has done is He's revealed, inspired this book that gives us the principles for living our life. And that when I was first trained as a Bible teacher, our approach to the Bible was to go to a verse or a couple verses or three verses and try to glean from those verses principles to live by. And my whole mindset going into it was, there's something, God wouldn't have put this there if there wasn't something in these few verses that God wants me to learn and know and understand that I need to then take and live my life by, some principle that I need to use in living my life. It may be more or less hidden. I may need to know some exegetical tricks to be able to get that principle out. But one way or the other, there's some principle there for me to abstract, and that's what I'm going to take and live my life by. I soon came to learn, the more I studied the Bible, that that's not actually what the Bible is. God didn't reveal the Scriptures in order to give me an instruction book about how to live. He's doing something else entirely. I'll talk about that in a second. So in the same vein, it's not an instruction manual on how to do Christianity, I mean, let alone life. It's not an instruction manual on how to do the Christian faith. It's not an instruction manual on how to do church. It's not an instruction manual on how to do ministry. It's not a guidebook on how to be good. And that's not what it is. It's something else. And what it is, I came to recognize over the course of time and more years of studying it, is that it is a record of God having come and revealed Himself to mankind in order that through that record we can come to know who God is. We can come to know who we are in relationship to God, the creatures that we are and the kind of creatures that we are. Through that record, through that interaction of God with mankind, we come to understand what our relationship to God is and what it ought to be. We come to understand through the things that God revealed to various people at various points in history, through various means, He came to reveal what His purposes are. Why are we here? What is this all about? What is this all for? We come to understand through that record what God has promised us with respect to those purposes. And just in general, we come to understand what this is all about, what life is all about. There are many, many different forms in which that information is conveyed to us. There's the story of God with respect to a particular people, the Jews, and all that He taught them and all that He did in relationship to them. This weird, peculiar relationship of a covenant with those people where He's going to be their God and they're going to be His people has nothing to do with me directly, but in the process of reading about God interacting with those people, I come to learn about God. And those people are a lot like me, so I come to learn a lot about myself in the process as well. Then you have the prophets, where more directly, God is simply speaking into our situation and proclaiming to us what His purposes are, what His promises are, how history is going to go, what it's going to look like, and so on. Then you have Jesus come on the scene, and you have Jesus Himself, who's the prophet of all prophets, the light of the world, the one who finally comes and speaks into our situation, the final pieces to this puzzle that puts it all together so that we can have a total and complete and coherent picture of what God's purposes are and what exactly He's promised and what I'm here for, what this is all about. And then we have an extension of that in the apostles, in the letters that they wrote, where the apostles, who are qualified to be spokesmen for Jesus, as we talked about earlier in the quarter, being qualified to speak for Jesus, can explore further what is it that God has purposed and what is this all about, and therefore what perspective should we have on our lives and our existence. That's what the Bible is. And as such, I need to recognize, and this is my next point, I need to recognize that when I'm reading the Bible, I'm not reading a Bible that has direct and immediate relevance to me. That's sort of provocative and heretical to a lot of people's ears, a lot of Christians' ears, but it's the truth. This book is a record that is about God dealing with other people, speaking to other people, writing to other people, punishing other people, judging other people, training up other people. This is not about me directly. If you take, for example, the letters of the apostles to the churches, I'm eavesdropping when I read the letter to the Romans or the Galatians or the Ephesians or the Philippians. I'm eavesdropping on a communication between somebody who I don't really know. I mean, I don't know Paul, I don't know Peter, I don't know John. I know they're apostles, and I know a little bit about them. I know their name, but beyond that, without reading the letter, I don't already know them. So there's a communication from an unknown person to an unknown audience on an unknown subject, addressing an unknown subject in the context of a culture I don't know and a language that I don't know on an occasion that I don't know. So you can see why the Bible is such a difficult book to read. I start at ground zero. I don't know nothing just going into it. And I need to simply glean from this letter all the clues that I can find that are going to tell me about who the author is and who the audience is and what his point is and what his message is and what his concern is, what the question or problem was that he was addressing. All that I need to reconstruct as I look at the text and work with the text and take the clues that are there to reconstruct everything about the letter that I need to know before I can even presume to understand it. That's true of the letters. It's less true, but also to a certain extent true of every other sort of genre in the Bible. Okay, so given that then, how do we apply the Bible? Let me talk about that for a second. As I would understand the process, the first thing we need to do is decide what the text, whatever it might be, I'm going to use a letter, an epistle, as my kind of paradigm. We'd need to adjust it for historical literature or the wisdom literature or prophetic literature. We'd have to adjust this a little bit. But just as a paradigm case, let me take one of Paul's letters, something like that. First, we have to decide what the text was intended by, say, Paul, the author, to mean as a communication to its intended audience. And we've talked, David and Ron spoke to the issue of different aspects of how you go about doing that. But that's the first order of business, is we need to try to understand what did Paul intend to say to the Romans, if it's the book of Romans. Now, in the process of coming to understand what Paul intended to mean to the Romans, we will usually come to understand why the human author said what he said to his intended audience, usually. Oftentimes, you can't separate those two. You can't understand what he was saying without understanding also why he was saying it. Sometimes you might be able to, and if you do, then that's the next order of business. If you, not only what he said, but also why was he saying it. So we go to that next step. In the process of determining why the author said what he did to his intended audience, we're going to necessarily be forced to make a determination with respect to what part that he's saying is transtemporal and transcultural. And what I mean by that is it's not only relevant to a particular time and place and culture, but it's relevant to all times and all places and all cultures. What part is transtemporal and transcultural, and what part derives from the local cultural situation and occasion? So part of understanding why he's saying what he's saying is going to force me to choose between what part of this is eternal truth, eternal wisdom, and what part of this is simply addressing particular values and truths that are located in that occasion. Now, having made that determination, which part is cultural and which part is eternal, the next step is, if we are believers who are trying to allow the Bible to be a source of wisdom to us, we're going to actually embrace the transtemporal, transcultural wisdom that's reflected in the author's text. We're going to take his instruction, we're going to take his counsel, and want to make it our own, that part that is eternal. Having embraced that, the eternal wisdom that is embedded in what he's saying, then we take that wisdom and we look at my own culture and my own circumstances and my own situation, and I ask myself the question, how does that wisdom dictate how I should think about and act within and respond to my culture and my situation? And that last step is, strictly speaking, what we might call application, what we ought to mean by applying the truth of the Bible. I'll have a little bit more to say about that in a second, but let me first try to use a metaphor to illustrate this process I was just describing. If you were to take two strands, two ropes, and tie them together, and one of the strands is the truth that describes the human situation, who God is, who we are, what the created order is, what God is up to, why we are here, what is reality, what are God's promises, those things that are eternally and forever true for every time and place and culture. That's this strand. In this strand over here, we have various facts, values, given assumptions, established assumptions of my culture and my time and place in history. If you tie those together, the knot that ties those together is all we're ever going to really find in the Bible. The Bible is a string of knots that has always tied together the eternal wisdom that the prophets or the apostles understand and has tied that together with certain cultural information in order to convey that wisdom to their time, to their place, to their culture, to the audience that is the contemporary to them in one way or the other. So as I look at the scriptures, this series of knots where eternal truth has been tied together with cultural realities, I'm never looking at instruction or counsel that is directly and immediately addressed to and relevant to me. It's always addressed to and relevant to whoever the contemporary audience was. So, in the task of learning from the Bible, I need to untie each and every one of those knots so that I can pull out separately the strand of truth that is eternal and the strand of that is simply cultural and occasional and local information and values and assumptions. And I need to take those apart. What I want to keep, what's relevant to me, is directly relevant to me, is this one strand over here of eternal truth. That's what I'm looking for. That's why I'm studying the Bible, is to be able to pull that strand up. But that's not enough. That's enough to know what the wisdom is and know how to articulate that wisdom to others. But this is not merely about knowing wisdom. This is about doing wisdom in the final analysis. And that's where application comes in. How am I going to do this truth that is eternal and transtemporal and transcultural? I need to take a whole nother strand, which is my knowledge of growing up in my culture. And I'm going to tie my own knots now, where I merge that truth, which is eternal wisdom from God, with the information I understand about my own time and place in history. And it's that tying that knot for myself with respect to my own culture that is the process of application. Okay, what I want to do is take a very, very simple example to start with, and then I'm going to take a much more complex example, and then we'll be done, and I'll let you ask your questions. But first, let me take something out of Ephesians 6, just a simple little statement. This is in the context of that fairly well-known passage about the spiritual armor, the armor of God. 6:19-20. This is the passage, finally, verse 10, finally be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might, put on the full armor of God so that you may be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places, and so on and so forth. You take up the full armor of God, the sword of the Spirit, and all that stuff. And 17, and take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. Now here's the verse I want to look at. With all prayer and petition, pray at all times in the Spirit. And with this in view, be on the alert with all perseverance and petition for all the saints. And pray on my behalf that utterance may be given to me in the opening of my mouth to make known with boldness the mystery of the gospel. Okay. I would hope that it's not controversial to recognize that verse 19, where he says, and pray on my behalf that utterance may be given to me in the opening of my mouth to make known with boldness the mystery of the gospel, does not directly and immediately apply to me at all. It has no direct relevance to me. Paul's dead. There is no more opportunity for him to have an opportunity to open his mouth and make known with boldness the mystery of the gospel. It's already too late for that. So that's not going to be a prayer that I'm going to pray out of obedience to Ephesians 6:19. It wouldn't make any sense for me to do that. I hope that's non-controversial. So Does the verse just have no relevance to me at all? Well, no, that's going too far. Because we can ask ourselves the question, why exactly is Paul asking the Ephesians to pray for him, to pray that he might have an opportunity to make known with boldness the mystery of the gospel? Well, asking that question now raises some very, very interesting questions about our view of reality, our view of the world. Why do we pray for that kind of thing? And here we have room for disagreement theologically. I mean, you may not all agree with my interpretation of this thing. You may be right, and I may be wrong. But I'm inclined, not only because of here, but other places, a couple of other places where Paul does something similar, that the reason Paul is asking them to pray that is not because Paul has a kind of voodoo view of prayer that sees incantations and rites and rituals and religious stuff as somehow bringing to bear the power of God on his life and his situation in a way that it wouldn't be there if we didn't go into the incantations and the mumbo-jumbo. Now, I might be wrong about that, and there are a whole lot of people who have a view of prayer that's exactly what prayer is all about, that prayer is some sort of magical ritual that God has asked us to engage in order to unleash his power in a way that God himself will not impart that power, apart if not mediated through the mumbo-jumbo of our magical ritual. But there's another alternative here, and that is the reason he's asking them to pray is because Paul understands that you pray for what you deeply want, that prayer reflects what is valuable to you and what is important to you and what is of focal interest to you of some kind. And so asking the Ephesians to pray that he might have an opportunity to make known with boldness the mystery of the gospel is a way of asking them to care about the success of the gospel in the Roman Empire, to care about its advance, to care about its spread, to care about its taking hold and transforming that world. Just for the sake of argument tonight, let's assume that I'm right about that. So we've seen what he's praying. What he's intending his audience to hear is clear enough. I want you to pray this for me. Why? That's harder to come by, but I'm stipulating that the why is because he wants the Ephesians to have this on their heart, to have this concern, the advance of the gospel in the Roman Empire on their hearts. If that's the case, I can untie this knot now. This verse no longer really has anything to do about me praying for Paul, but there is a piece, there's a strand that has been woven together with the particular occasion upon which he's writing this that remains true even when we remove it from this context. Namely, as a believer, as a disciple of Jesus, one thing that ought to be interesting to me is the advance and spread of the gospel in the world. That ought to be interesting to me. I ought to want as many people as possible to have their eyes opened so that they can recognize the truth of the gospel, the goodness of the kingdom of God, and a desire to be there. And that's not only true of the Ephesians, it's been true for thousands and thousands of years. Every believer should have that characterize the focus of their heart. What does that mean in my situation then? Okay. Well, it's not going to mean that I pray for the Apostle Paul, obviously, but there's all kinds of ways that that can manifest itself in my culture, some of which Paul never would have even dreamt of. Giving financial support to missionaries going to particular places where those people might hear the gospel, for example. Praying for other people who are missionaries in other contexts that opportunity might be given them and that they might boldly be able to make known the mystery of the gospel. It's not Paul, but it's somebody else. That's okay. I'm now the Ephesians were back then. Now, that's a fairly straightforward and obvious example, and I think pretty non-controversial. Let me take a more complicated example. My apologies to some of you who may have sat through Ron's teaching of this for 3 weeks at Reformation Fellowship, but this is the absolutely best example in the Bible, I think, for recognizing the difference between culture and eternal truth, and that's why I want to go there. This is the also probably pretty well-known passage about Paul exhorting the women to wear head coverings when they're pray or prophesy in church. I won't go into it in the detail that Ron did, but just to look at it closely enough to be able to make a point about what this process looks like. Be imitators of me, just as I also am of Christ. Now I praise you because you remember, I'm in 1 Corinthians 11, by the way. I praise you because you remember me in everything and hold firmly to the traditions just as I delivered them to you. But I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man, and the man is the head of a woman, and God is the head of Christ. Every man who has something on his head while praying or prophesying disgraces his head, but every woman who has her head uncovered while praying or prophesying disgraces her head, for she is one and the same as the woman whose head is shaved. For if a woman does not cover her head, let her also have her hair cut off, but if it is disgraceful for a woman to have her hair cut off or her head shaved, let her cover her head. For a man ought not to have his head covered, since he is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of man. For man does not originate from woman, but woman from man. For indeed man was not created for the woman's sake, but woman for the man's sake. Therefore the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. However, in the Lord neither is woman independent of man, nor is man independent of woman. For as the woman originates from the man, so also the man has his birth through the woman, and all things originate from God. Judge for yourselves, is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not even nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it is a dishonor to him? But if a woman has long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given to her for a covering. But if one is inclined to be contentious, we have no other practice, nor have the churches of God. Okay. The thing to not do in approaching a passage like this is to come to loggerheads over the issue of, is this cultural or is this not cultural? Which is where the debate usually goes. It's like we have to decide, this is cultural or this is not cultural. And most of us, if those are the options, are going to say it's cultural. I mean, we're not wearing head coverings in churches these days. So most of us have said, this is just cultural, this doesn't apply to us. But if my description of how what the Bible is and how it works is right, we have to remember that every passage is a knot where tied together are certain realities that are cultural realities and other realities that are eternal realities. So even if this doesn't directly and immediately apply to us, in the sense that it's commanding us validly today to wear head, if we're women, to wear head coverings when we pray or prophesy in church, even if that's not true, there's still nevertheless something of eternal wisdom that has been incorporated into Paul's counsel here. So my task in biblical exegesis is to get in there and sort out that part of it that is cultural from that part of it which is eternal, in order that I can keep that part of it which is eternal and then can apply it in my own situation in a way that's relevant to my culture and to my circumstances. So what do we do with this passage? For the longest time, I never thought that women ought to pray or prophesy with their head covered. I was never there. That didn't make any sense to me. And by the way, I think that's legitimate. I mean, your first impulse to say, this is cultural. Why? Because it's obvious to you that it's cultural. Obvious to you in a way that it couldn't possibly have been obvious to them back then, because they're too much a product of their culture. But people who are outside of a culture can see a lot more clearly what is cultural within somebody else's culture than somebody inside the culture. And we're way outside this culture. of 1 Corinthians. So we look at it and we go, Paul, this can't be about wearing stuff on your head. I mean, whoever God is and whatever God is, he could care less about your head being covered or not covered. That's just obvious. And I think it's not wrong for us to have that perspective, because we've learned a lot about God in reading the Bible. We've read passages where Peter says, you know, it's not how you dress. We've read passages by Paul where it says, you don't judge people from the outside. I mean, we understand that. And this would be completely and utterly inconsistent with everything else that we know and understand about God and his values if all of a sudden we get to 1 Corinthians 11 and Paul is saying, God really, really cares about women having their heads covered. I mean, that's really crucial to him. It just doesn't make any sense. So hastily coming to that conclusion is probably on good grounds. Our intuitions are very right about that. But what always tripped me up about this passage is, on first blush, because we're not there in the culture, we don't know what the occasion is, we don't know what the question is, you read something like verse... Where is it? The one about authority. Oh, 10. Therefore, the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. You read that, and it tends to steer you in a direction where you've got a passage where the question is, should women uncover their heads when they pray or prophesy? And Paul is saying, well, because of these things in Genesis, a woman ought to have the head covering on her head as a symbol of authority. So we are led, I think, to think that the issue here is a bit of rebellion or uppityness or presumption on the part of women who are desperately wanting to uncover their heads when they pray or prophesy, but Paul, along with the other men in the church, are making sure that they don't do that. I mean, it tends to have that feel about it. And so because I was sort of in that rut in looking at this passage, I didn't get what was going on here. It wasn't until I was in Nigeria, in southern Nigeria, scheduled to teach at a church. And we were in the part of the worship service where they were singing songs. And everybody should experience this at one point in their lives. I've never seen so many different sounds come out of hands clapping as in that congregation. It was just beautiful. It was wonderful. So I was enjoying this, all this music. And periodically they would have prayer during the worship service. And whenever they had prayer, they would all stand, and all the men would reach up and remove this incredibly intricate headgear that they wore, would remove it from their heads during the prayer, and then put it back on their heads after the prayer and sit down. And it just clicked for me there. Bingo. That's exactly what's going on in 1 Corinthians. It's got to be what's going on. I don't know how I had missed it, because he says it explicitly here. Every man who has something on his head while praying or prophesying disgraces his head. I mean, Paul says it explicitly. What the men in Nigeria were doing is they didn't want to diss God, so they removed the head covering from their head as a show of respect for their Lord and their Savior and their Creator. It would have been a disgrace to their head, their Lord, to have left the head covering on their head. So they removed it. And I flashed on this verse, and I said, that's exactly what was going on in Corinth. Then he goes on, but every woman who has her head uncovered while praying or prophesying disgraces her head, and he's told us in the passage earlier that that's her husband, that for her to remove her head covering would disgrace her husband, so we'll get to that. Well, anyway, with that piece of information, I could come back to this passage, and I realized, we've got a very interesting situation here. Women have never worshipped alongside, these women in Corinth have never had an experience of their life of worshipping alongside men. Women in the synagogues were spectators. They were not participants in worship. They sat in a particular part of the synagogue and watched the men worship. So they never prayed. They never prophesied. This was not an issue of what do you do when you pray or prophesy to God, because they'd never done it before in their lives. For the first time, Christianity has come along, or the belief in Jesus has come along, and you have this mixing of Gentile and Jew together, of people who are believing in Jesus and wanting to honor God in view of the gospel brought by Jesus. Women are welcome to participate in this service. So they're praying right alongside men, and they are prophesying right alongside men. But herein lies the problem. Men have made it a practice to remove their head covering when they pray or prophesy in order to show their respect for God. Now we have a dilemma. What is a woman supposed to do? When she stands up to pray or prophesy, does she show respect for God by removing her head covering? It would make sense. The men do that, it would make sense that they should remove their head covering. But there's the rub. The problem is there are other cultural realities in that culture as well, and that is a woman does not remove a head covering in public, because if she were to remove a head covering in public, it would be incredibly disgraceful to her husband. Co-pastor at another of a church I was at in California, when he was in the service, had been in Turkey. I believe it was Turkey. And he was in the marketplace, walking down the dusty path in the marketplace, and accidentally stepped on the very long veil of a Muslim woman and pulled it off. And because he stepped on it, it ended up pulling it off her head. He barely escaped with his life. I mean, he had to run and get away from crowds of people who came rushing after him to kill him because he had done something so disgraceful. Now, we have a little trouble relating to that. We who bear it all in public can't understand the emotions involved in that, but the culture of Corinth is much more likely to be closer to the Islamic culture in that regard than anything like we know in Western culture today. I mean, probably, given the strength of what Paul is saying here, it may not be an exaggeration. Maybe this is a slight exaggeration, but it may not be an exaggeration to say it would be like a woman stripping her clothes off and praying or prophesying naked to God. I mean, that's how outrageous it would have been in their culture, I think. That's how shocking, how outlandish it would have been. And so Paul is saying, well, okay. Now, that's probably an exaggeration, because if it were that strong, then it wouldn't even be probably an issue. But we have to understand that there's a cultural symbol here that runs pretty deep for them. And that is, it's not going to show any honor or respect for your husband if you were to take the head covering off of your head to pray and prophesy. So what this passage is all about, and we won't be able to get into the details, but what this passage is all about is, I don't think the women in this context are being at all rebellious or uppity. They've got a problem. They have an honest, sincere dilemma that they're faced with. We are to pray or prophesy, and we certainly want to show respect to our Lord and our Creator when we pray or prophesy, which would seem to imply that we should take our head coverings off. But we're not taking our head coverings off because that would be a diss to our husbands. What are we to do? So Paul is being called upon to make a judgment about truths as they would apply in that culture. So Paul makes a judgment call, and his judgment, and so what is the nature of his judgment call? Ultimately, the nature of his judgment call has to be not a reading of truth, but a reading of his culture. I mean, the question is, I mean, how should this be decided? It should be decided by asking the question, which is the stronger cultural symbol in this case? If a woman were to stand up and remove her head covering in a public worship service in our midst, what are people going to think? Are they going to look at that and go, how sweet, she loves her Lord? Or are they going to go, how outlandish, how outrageous, what a disrespectful, shameful thing to do with respect to her relationship with her husband? And Paul's judgment is, it's going to be the latter. They're not going to look at that and respect and appreciate and acknowledge your love of God if you take your head covering off. All they're going to see, all they're going to know from what you've done is that you've done something shameful and outlandish with respect to the sanctity of your marriage to your husband. That's what they're going to see. And given that, what's the right thing to do? The right thing to do is not diss your husband, because women ought not to diss their husbands. And we can go to Genesis for that, basically. So he appeals to Genesis because Genesis has something to say about the marriage relationship, the sanctity of the marriage relationship, and most importantly, a certain peculiar lack of symmetry in the marriage relationship, which is crucial to his point. Yes, husbands should remove head coverings when they pray or prophesy in church. They should do that. They owe their honor and praise and respect to their Creator God. As do women. As do wives. The wives owe that to their God as well. However, there's something about the wives in relationship to their husbands that's not true of a husband in relationship to their wife. And that's what our symbol of head coverings in public symbolizes, is that relationship between the husband and the wife. Namely, as Paul puts it, that the woman was created to be a helper to the husband and not the other way around. And it's somehow that the role of a wife as being created by God for her husband that Paul deems to be somehow embodied in and captured by that cultural symbol of women wearing head coverings in public. And so what Paul says is, that's true. That's an eternal created truth, that marriage is of that nature and that wives relate to their husbands in that particular way. That's true. So are we wanting to send a symbol that repudiates what Genesis teaches? I don't think so. So leave them on. Leave your head coverings on and allow that truth that Genesis teaches to be communicated, respected, honored, and expressed by your cultural symbol. Seems to me, Paul says, to be the right thing to do. But what's interesting in this passage is he knows that he's making a judgment call, because notice how he ends this. If anyone is inclined to be contentious, we have no other practice, nor have the churches of God. That is, in the end, he says, I think at this point when he says, if you're inclined to be contentious, being contentious about this would not be like being contentious over whether Jesus raised from the dead or whether our sins are forgiven by God's grace or something like that. Being contentious over this would be to make a different judgment call about what cultural symbols are more powerful. And an inspired apostle doesn't have any particular advantage over anybody else in making that judgment call. But Paul says, this is the one that in our churches, this is the judgment call we've made, this is what we do. Notice a few verses earlier, 13, Paul says, judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? He's appealing to them. They're students of their culture, just as much as Paul is. Paul may know the gospel in an inspired, infallible kind of way, but he's no more a student or an expert on their culture than they are. And so he leaves it in their hands. Judge for yourselves. Wouldn't we see it as shameful? Wouldn't it be dishonorable for a woman to do that? Okay. So what have we got here again? What Paul has done is he's taken some truths out of Genesis. He's tied them together with some realities, some cultural symbols that really are cultural symbols in that time and place and culture. And he's tied them together in a particular way. We as believers who want to uphold what the Bible teaches in Genesis about marriage, the way to express that and honor that truth in our context would be, for example, for women to not remove their head covering when they pray or prophesy in public. So that's tied together in a particular way. In my interpretation of the passage, I need to come to appreciate and acknowledge that what I'm faced with here in 1 Corinthians 11 is this knot that has tied together certain cultural realities together with certain eternal realities, eternal truths. I separate them. I recognize which part is cultural and which part is eternal. And which part is cultural? Namely, it just simply is not a cultural reality today that a woman having her head covered means anything. It doesn't mean nothing. A woman can have her head covered or not have her head covered. Well, depends on what kind of cover, I suppose. If you came with a veil, we'd think you're kind of strange. But basically, it doesn't have any meaning in our culture, one way or the other. So you can do whatever you want to do. Covered, not covered. Doesn't make any difference to us. Doesn't make any difference to God. Doesn't send any signals of any kind. Doesn't send any messages of any kind. And if it's not sending any messages, then you're free to do whatever you want to do. What was of concern to Paul back then is it was sending a message, and to remove the head covering would send the wrong message. So we separate out that part that's cultural, namely what has cultural meaning, from that which is transtemporal, transcultural, namely marriage is marriage. Marriage was designed by God to be a particular kind of relationship and have a particular purpose and to have a particular structure to it that's asymmetrical. A husband is not to the wife what the wife is to the husband. There's the man is the head and the woman is the helper. And whatever that means, and we can talk about that, but whatever that means, that's embedded in the very creation account in Genesis itself. And Paul says that's significant. We have revealed to us what marriage is from the beginning. So we separate that out. Now we're in a position where we can ask, does that have any relevance to how we behave in the church today, for example? Well, it might. But there, we then simply need to become students of our culture, because we need to be able to appreciate what are the powerful cultural messages that our actions would have in our culture. I've lived in this culture all my life. I'm in a position to somehow appreciate what that might be, and I need to respect that. I can't disregard that, because whether I like it or not, my actions are going to speak to my culture, whatever cultural meaning my actions have to my culture. And in acknowledging that, I want to make sure that my actions don't defy what is eternal truth, but actually support and is compatible with eternal truth. And that, because that's what Paul is doing. It's exactly what Paul is doing in 1 Corinthians 11, is asking, what way can we behave that's going to support, ratify, and be compatible with eternal truth rather than be at odds with it? One last comment, and then I'll open it up to your questions. Leaving 1 Corinthians 11, if you have, there's all kinds of deals and details in here that if you have questions about, I'd be glad to address as well. But one last comment. One of the places that's most contentious when it comes to how do you apply the truths of the Bible come to things like politics, social theory, economics. You'll have any number of people who will talk about here's a biblical form of government, or here's a biblical economics, or here's a biblical way to look at the upcoming vote, the upcoming election, and this measure on the ballot, what's the biblical perspective on this measure on the ballot, and so on. I have no quarrel with that. I think we should try to come to a biblical perspective on candidates and measures and propositions and economics and politics and so on, on the one hand. On the other hand, we need to recognize that when we talk about a biblical perspective on them, we are going to be tying one of those knots. We are going to be taking what we understand from the Bible, eternal truths that we take from the Bible, and we're also going to be taking our understanding of the cultural realities of politics and government and economics and technology and whatever else. This we know because it's been through a book that's been inspired by God. This eternal wisdom of God that makes up what we call the gospel has been spoken to us and taught to us by authoritative spokesmen. We can be pretty confident about that. But I don't have an inspired, infallible interpretation of economics and government and statehood and candidates and propositions. And some of that stuff gets awfully complicated. And therefore, I think, there is certainly room for disagreement among believers with respect to the biblical perspective on how to vote in this upcoming election. Why? Because not because we're both right. No, we're probably not both right. We're probably both wrong. But because the issues are complicated enough that I may genuinely believe the truth of the gospel and the truth of the Bible, but have a different take on economics than you do, or have a different take on what the best kind of governmental structure might be, or the best view of technology might be. We just may disagree on other values that are not explicitly given to us by the scriptures, by the Bible. We can still hold our views as strongly and as firmly with the conviction that we have, and that's fine. But the mistake we would make is to judge people as not genuinely believers, not genuinely Christians. They don't really respect the Bible because they don't have the same politics that I do. Well, that doesn't follow. That doesn't really make any sense. They may genuinely love God, they just have a really lousy view of economics or a really lousy view of politics. I mean, of course I don't, but they must. So it's important when it comes to applying the Bible in those very sensitive areas that we don't judge the spirit of another person by the outside, the externality of their politics, but rather by their heart. Who do they love? What do they love? And they may be misinformed or misguided in some sense about what they think it means, what the political implications of that are. But okay. God is not going to let us into heaven because we passed Econ 101 successfully and got that right. It's going to be the condition of our heart. Okay, hopefully there's something there for discussion.
Are there any guidelines for being able to figure out when an apostle is appealing to an eternal truth versus just a cultural truth? For example, in verse 9, when he says, "Indeed, man was not created for the woman's sake, but woman for the man's sake," you know, it's pretty clear that he's harking back to Genesis there, first couple chapters. But when he says something like in 14, "Does not even nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it is a dishonor to him?" It would sound at first glance like he's making an eternal claim here that, you know, look at nature. But, you know, when I first read that, my response is no. I mean, being in Eugene, you see mullets and dreadlocks all the time. And
look at the pictures of Jesus.
So it's not that it's, you know, at most it's, oh, that's kind of gross or ugly, or maybe on some guys it looks cool, but it's not an issue of dishonor. And I wouldn't say that, no, nature doesn't teach that it's a dishonor.
Right. Right.
So is that a cultural claim that he's making? I mean, for him to say, does not even nature itself teach that, is that influenced by the fact that in his culture, long hair was a symbol of disgrace?
Well, I would see this as, again, a knot that is tying together something that is not cultural with something that is cultural. Because what I think he means by does not even nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it is a dishonor to him. What nature teaches him, well, I think what he means by nature here is natural psychology. Our natural attitudes that seem to be built into us and natural to us. But with respect to what is the question? I don't think it's with respect to long hair. I think it's with respect to the man-woman relationship, husband-wife relationship. Doesn't nature itself teach you that if you had the nature of the relationship inverted from what you find in Genesis, doesn't even nature itself teach you there's something wrong with that, something perverse about that? So I think that's what he means by doesn't nature teach you. But he puts it in a cultural form, because the best I can do at this point is to assume that long hair on women is sort of a corollary to having their head covered. That is having, because he earlier said, if you're going to take your veil off, you might as well cut your hair or shave it. If the one is a dishonor, so is the other. The two cultural realities are working together in that culture. Having long hair to begin with, and then covering your head with clothing, an artificial covering, are both part of the same picture of showing a particular kind of relationship to a husband, a woman showing a certain relationship to her husband. So he says, doesn't even nature itself teach you that if a man were communicating that he had that relationship to his wife, that would be a dishonor to him? I mean, I think what Paul is saying is, do you even need the Bible to tell you that? I mean, did I even need to appeal to Genesis? Doesn't even nature itself teach you that? Your own natural psychology. So do you see that there's both going on there at once? It's not the long hair, because the long hair in our culture doesn't mean that any longer. It doesn't have that significance. But the long hair would have had that significance in that culture, and so he's saying what that long hair means to us in our culture, if you were to communicate that, what having a long hair means on a man would mean, wouldn't that be disgraceful to us? Or just a dishonor to him? So what would be the counterpart in our culture? Maybe if one day we all came dressed in drag. I'm not sure that were... Yeah, exactly right. It's going to be hard to find a symbol. But, you know, maybe if we were to come dressed in drag, I think Paul would say, doesn't nature teach you that this is not the way to go?
Or for all the Sunday school night class in tuxedos.
Yeah, except that, I mean, I know you're just joking, but it is important that there's a serious point here, and that is, it's important that something not just be odd within a culture, but it be meaningful in a culture, that it actually have some kind of meaning that can be articulated, because then you are measuring against truth. Does the message that this thing is communicating line up with truth or not line up with truth? If it's just odd, I'm not sure Paul would have any particular problem with it. I mean, you'd wonder why you're doing it, but it's not the same sort of thing that this is. Because this actually is saying something. Than having your long hair or having your head shaved, having your head covered or not covered is actually saying something specifically, I think.
So learning to untie those knots, like we just did there, takes practice?
It takes practice. It's a skill. All of biblical exegesis is that. I think that's an important point to make, is that biblical exegesis is not a science. You can't program a computer to do it. It's not a technique. It's not a step-by-step, first do this, and then do this, and then do this, and then do this. It's an art. That is, it's something that that a person needs to teach himself to do. And when he's taught himself to do it, he doesn't even know what it is he knows how to do. But he knows how to do it because he can perform it. That's why it's not always easy for an exegete to tell you why they prefer one interpretation over another, any more than it would be possible for a wine taster to tell you why this wine is better than that wine. It just is. I tasted it, and I recognized the difference. Polanyi's tacit knowledge. Biblical exegesis is like that, that it's this art, this skill that you develop through practice, and you're not always able to reduce what it is that you know to some kind of technique or steps or even articulate the knowledge you have. As you're passing the mic, I never did understand why this was so popular, but back in the 60s there was a popular movement called the Joy of Discovery. It was a Bible study movement, and they had reduced Bible study to 3 steps. Maybe I've told you this before, I don't know. But they had reduced Bible study to 3 steps. And I think the idea that you'd reduce Bible study to 3 steps made it seem manageable, and so, oh, great, I just have to do these 3 things and then I will be a Bible student. The 3 steps were observe what the text says, decide what it means, and then apply it. Okay.
I was going to ask about the head covering thing again, because there's still, I mean, God bless the Amish, you know, and the Mennonites, I mean, but what I'm wondering is, when you see people dressed up like Little House on the Prairie in the 21st century, you almost wonder, and I don't necessarily mean this to be a comment as much as maybe you can, what you know about Paul and how he valued in the way he lived his life. I mean, circumcising a guy over here, making sure another guy wasn't circumcised over here, making sure the gospel met everybody's without compromise. I wonder about when people actually offend other people, not because of the message of the gospel, but they offend other people by the I will have nothing to do with you. No, I had it in my mind before I asked the question. Sorry, it's the
I'm better than you. I'm apart from you.
The elitist the elitist attitude is what the American Gentile would see, as opposed to the love of God. Do you? Am I pushing it too far with this kind of? I'm curious of what Paul's perspective would be on this. I mean, conservatism is one thing. I mean, but the other part of it is the other part of that equation. This knot tying is okay. Then how far are we going to lower the bar? The Mennonites have the bar here, having a beard without a mustache or whatever, and gray clothing. And they've decided, I'm not going to lower the bar any more than that. Other denominations and belief systems have not been off-putting to our surrounding culture, therefore possibly getting a foothold with the gospel message, mm-hmm. as opposed to repelling it.
Well, okay, so Paul's own practice, his own practice was to become all things to all people, so he wouldn't have any problem with dressing like the Amish if he was going to go into an Amish community or not... You know, not dressing like the Amish when he was not in an Amish community. I mean, that's a deliberate strategy that he articulates for. He doesn't want to let anything get in the way unnecessarily of him having a hearing and speaking. Not because I think he would have any problem with there being cultures that are separate. For example, his countrymen, the Jews, who had a very distinctive culture. I don't think he had a problem with that. But as his own individual role to be an apostle to the Gentiles, he realized that that could create barriers that he didn't want to be there. So he was willing to drop outwardly, externally, his Jewishness for the sake of making converts among the Gentiles. So I think it's going too far to say because Paul did that deliberately for the sake of his mission that every believer who's genuinely a believer everywhere will necessarily allow themselves to become incognito in any culture. I don't think that necessarily follows, because we just have different callings. And I think to have a distinctive... I mean, there's something kind of classy about wearing your commitment to your Lord externally on your in your very peculiar odd dress. I mean, there's something kind of weirdly attractive about that, in a way. I mean, there's no question about who I am. I was on a train in Switzerland, and I got in conversation with a woman, and she found out I was a pastor, and she asked me if I was a Mormon, and I said no. She said, oh, yeah, I didn't think so. You can spot those Mormons 2 kilometers away. But the fact that you would have a distinctive culture that would just, you know, kind of broadcast to people, this is what I stand for, this is what I am. If I, as a believer in Jesus and in the Bible, were to dress in a way that would just sort of broadcast that, I don't think that would be inappropriate, but it would be a tremendous temptation. And that's the other side of it, is one thing that we know, if we understand the New Testament, is authentic discipleship is inward, not outward. And if I could broadcast to you that I'm a disciple of Jesus just by wearing certain clothes, then I wouldn't have to worry about my insides. You know, the temptation would be, I don't have to worry about my insides. And that's why I don't dress funny. I don't want to be tempted to rely upon my outward dress.
That cultural phenomenon is kind of interesting, because we've got some very dear friends who are in the Reformed tradition. They're not Amish, they're not Mennonites, but the women all wear head coverings. And they're convinced that it's an eternal principle from this passage. I wouldn't call them legalistic. That's just where they're at. But what's really interesting is we were with them this last summer down in Southern California, the land of flesh. And we were at a restaurant. In fact, it was a Marie Callender's, and a man and woman from some Middle Eastern culture saw this family there, and they almost had tears. And
they had head covering in
this Middle Eastern culture.
Calendar?
This Middle Eastern family, or a man and woman, saw these friends of ours. We were with them having dinner.
But your friends, the woman had a
yes. Oh. She, yeah, the woman and the kids.
So not just in church.
That's correct. Hmm. Yeah, all the time.
Okay.
But this man and woman came up to him almost with tears in their eyes, excited that there was this family that was somehow showing some kind of respect for God. The kids showed respect for the parents, and it really stood out down in that environment in particular, in Southern California. It was a very pretty moving experience for them, because they were new to this culture, this husband and wife, and were not very impressed down there. And their garb, this friend's of ours' garb, meant something to them, having come from a Middle Eastern culture where that was very important.
Mm-hmm. Jack, I'm just kind of describe how I'm sort of thinking about this process, and maybe you can answer me, because I'm sort of wondering what the presuppositions must be in order to implicate this exegetical process, because I'm understanding it that we need to read scriptures and you know, there are the two twines, and we need to untwine them untie them. Now, it seems to me we're doing this rationally, that is, we're using our reason to decide what is what and what is what. So I sort of having a picture in my mind as having this document that's conveying some eternal truth, but we're using our reason to take an eternal truth out of it and then positing it again as eternal truth. So my question is, it seems to me that there's a lot of danger in that process, because you know, even if it's for a brief moment in our thought process, we're going from the inspired text through ourselves and our reason back to posting something as eternal. So my question is, it seems that if we say, well, we'll look for other eternal truths in the Bible, we may be set with the same question. Are we sort of deciding these for ourselves by using our reason and all the evidence available to us? Or Are there maybe some other presuppositions, philosophical presuppositions, that we have to start with before this entire process can be effective?
I was following you until your last two sentences.
My question is, if we do this exegetical process and we say, okay, I believe this is an eternal truth, well, it seems to me rational that we would want to verify that somewhere else.
Oh, okay.
And so my question is, if we try to do it within the scriptures, that process might be circular.
Okay.
Or are we maybe coming from the outside with other philosophical premises as our basis for that?
Okay. Let's see. I may be partly speaking past you, I don't know, but let me just try it, and you can come back at me if I'm not. What we would, growing up in the church, in the church culture, the things I'm saying tonight would probably have been pretty threatening to me, because I just sort of absorbed from my culture that there's a certain certainty that comes from the Bible, certain absoluteness and fixedness to what we can learn from the Bible that removes all risk. What I'm describing in this process, and I think that's partly what's behind your question, is no, this is a risky process. We can get it wrong. I can go to the Bible and I can misinterpret it, and I can not untie the knot successfully. I mean, like Terry's friends there, I have no doubt that they could be genuinely, authentically godly people, but they just read that passage differently than I do. They've come to different conclusions. Okay, that's okay. One of us is right, one of us is wrong. But just like all of the rest of our knowledge, I think it can be, if we don't get in the way, it can be self-correcting. I mean, that's been my experience in life. I've gone through different phases theologically in my life, and over the course of time, things that I was convinced were true, convinced was the theological system that made the most sense in the Bible, after time it began to fall apart and unravel on me. And usually it was because I was studying the Bible that was happening. I couldn't make that work in view of what I was reading over here in the scriptures. Now, there are some people who are going to go their whole life, and that'll never happen to them because they won't let it happen. They are so psychologically and emotionally invested in a particular theological system or theological construct that there's no way in hell that's ever going to be wrong. No way are they ever going to find any biblical evidence or otherwise against it. Well, that I would argue is a problem. It's at least an intellectual problem, a philosophical problem, and it may be a spiritual problem. I'll let God sort that out. But if I'm unwilling to grow and unwilling to learn, then I can short-circuit the process and I won't grow and I won't learn. But for the rest of us, yes, there's risk involved. I may get it wrong, but even if I get it wrong today, I can learn that I was wrong today 5 years from now. As I read more, as I study more, as I experience more. I mean, one of the things that makes nonsense out of a lot of our theology is just life. And it's easy to believe firmly in bad theology when you're young, because you haven't had enough life experience to show you how much it doesn't make any sense. So it's part of the answer to your question is, yeah, I think there are other sources besides Scripture itself. I think as we learn from reality, just by reflecting on life experience and reality in the world and God philosophically and otherwise, we learn some things that we come to know are true, and we recognize that those same truths I'm learning over here were actually here underlying what was being said in the Bible all along. I just didn't know that. I had been trained differently to see it differently. So I think the sources can be many and varied, but they're all legitimate. They're all valid because they're all teaching me about the truth. And the whole thing is supervised, I would argue, by the Spirit of God, who is the one leading me, who is the one discipling me, training me, teaching me. Did that get at what you're...
That was 90% of it.
Okay.
The other 10% would be... What you're meaning by eternal truth, then?
Okay.
Because that statement to me seems to signify something eternally valid.
Okay.
But if this is learning process,
right?
I would think maybe existential truth or a life truth.
Okay. Yeah. I see. I see your. Well, the reason I was calling it eternal truth is because ultimately what I think is tied together in the text is truth that is unchanging, that is eternal. Namely, I think the apostles supernaturally were given a gift by God that they got it. They really did get it. They really did understand as far as it went. They understood it. I may not understand it, however. I may think that I understand what they understand, and that's why 5 years from now I may realize, whoops, I didn't understand what they understand. And that's the self-correcting process where I come to make their understanding my understanding. But you're right, the best I can do in this process of interpretation is take what I think I see is the understanding that's eternal and apply that to my culture. I may, 10 years downstream, find out that what I thought was eternal wasn't even true. Yeah. Anything? Yeah.
Real quick question, or maybe it turn into two questions, but then three. No, just two. Anyway, was there ever a time, aside from the first generation of believers, that the church really said we want to grasp the idea that this was not written directly to us? And we want to really take seriously the idea of understanding the scripture as being to a certain set of people at a certain time, as you said, not speaking to us. Was there ever a time where that was, aside from the first generation, that was ever the case that the church and the believers were doing that? Has the opposite become a trend that started at a certain point in time? Or just as humans, have we always done it that way because we're self-centered and we just tend to think that things are written to us? That's my first question.
Okay. I don't really think I know enough to answer that. I know enough about history to answer that. The good exegetes have always approached it the way I have described here, I think. Calvin is great at this kind of thing. I don't think he always gets it right, but I think he really shows an appreciation for the need to sort out that which is cultural from that which is not. I mean, so any of the people that you would look at and see as really skilled and able exegetes throughout time, and they span span all of Christian history, we're able to grasp that that's what the task is. And at the same time, I would imagine coexisting with all of them would have been a lot of strange attitudes about what the Bible is that would go along with that.
And my other question is, and this is, I'm asking you as a man to simply give his opinion, how much what we see and recognize as visible church and what the visible church does and how it operates, how much is that a byproduct of
Christians somewhere, somehow not untangling and not untying the knot of eternal truth from the knot of cultural, Judaic, ceremonial religiousness? I don't know. It's just, I don't know if you can answer that or if that's...
I think that's a huge piece. Okay. That we justify a lot of our religiosity on the grounds of you see a lot of religiosity in the Bible, and that's true. You know, on the surface, at face value, how can you argue with that? The Old Testament is an incredibly religious book; puts us to shame, and so we feel fully justified in having our few paltry rituals and acts of piety and forms of spirituality, because look at all that stuff in the Old Testament. If God liked it back then, you know, you must still like it. But you're right. The problem is we haven't understood why God was appealing to the Jews religiously by inspiring a religion. And once we understand, I think, why he was inspiring a religion, that the whole argument falls apart. It's not because God is religious and likes religion. It's because he was doing a distinctive thing with a distinctive people at a distinctive time in history, and he had purposes for doing it this way. So, yeah.